Hello, and welcome back to Vox Popcast, the weekly pseudo-academic roundtable of pop culture analysis with drinking and swearing. My name is Christopher Maverick, but you can call me Mav, and I am once again here with my co-host, Wayne Wise. Hey, Wayne, welcome back. How's it going?
Hey, I'm good, Mav. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I was having to do the show without any of the regular co-hosts last week, but, like, it was fine. We did a joint show last week with our friends over at Protagonist with Andrew and Joe, and, yeah, no, they're essentially regulars.
Yeah, right, yeah, they've been on our show often enough that, yeah.
Yeah, and, I mean, there's been several shows, which, like last week's show, where we, you know, double release it, so that was fun. But how are you doing? You're back in...
Yeah, same old. I am prepping. We were just talking about this a little bit pre-recording. I'm prepping. I'm actually doing a presentation this week over at Pitt in a gender studies class on the history of the superheroine. So
that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so sticking my toe back in presentations on a college campus, which is good. Enjoy the process of that. So
hopefully I'll see you. It's already happened by the time, technically, the time this episode happens, it comes out. It has not happened yet, but there's no way for anybody to go do it. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
If you're already enrolled in that class.
Yes. Yeah, I hope you'll join me if you happen to be listening to this the day before I do this. But yeah, it's good to get back to putting together something like this. And like a lot of these things, I have 30, 40 minutes to talk about an 80 plus year history. So lots of highlights. Yeah, not a tremendous amount of depth, lots of highlights.
And as for prep, falling off a horse, I mean, I think you'll be fine.
Yeah, well, and that's it. So much of what I'm doing, I'm just lifting directly from other presentations I've done and restructuring it, so.
And by the way, yes, I know falling off a horse is not like I don't know why that's the version of, you know, getting back up on the bike or just like riding a bicycle that I use, but like for some reason, my version of, you know, something that's easy, that's my version of just like riding a bike is it's just like falling off a horse. And I don't know why I use that, but I've been saying it for years. I think it's like, you know, get back up on the horse again. And it's like, no, it's as easy as falling off a horse, which I think is actually easier than riding a bicycle.
Well, yes, because falling off of things is easier than
defense. Yeah, gravity helps with that.
Yeah, right. just like falling off a horse. It's fine. So the voice you're hearing, I'd like to welcome back to the show my wife, Stephanie Seiler, who has been nice enough to grace us with her presence today.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Steph.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
I haven't seen you in minutes.
It's been... You're gone for a little while there. Came back. I was worried.
Yeah. Anyway, so the reason Steph's here is that, Steph, you came up with a topic for the day, kind of.
Yeah, just like every once in a while, I'll be listening to the radio, and then I'll look up a song, and then I'll be like, oh, wow, this actually is a cover. It's not the original. Like a song that I had, you know, known for a very long time and never thought. Like, more recently, I've just been, like, doing some investigation, like looking up lyrics and finding out more about particular songs because, I don't know, I figure it's just that time in my life. I don't know where I'm.
Do you remember the first argument that we had over something like this?
Oh, yes, I think I do. I'm not sure if this is the very first argument, but one of the first arguments. When we first started. So Mav and I have been together since 1998. Mm-hmm. And yeah, early in that time, the song Kiss, which I knew is a song by Tom Jones, came up. And then Mav mentioned that Prince had actually written it.
I think the video came on television.
Oh, maybe,
and
yeah.
The Prince video came on TV and stuff was like, oh, wow, Prince covered this song.
Oh, yeah, that's what happened. Okay. Like, yeah, because I only knew it as a Tom Jones song. I did not know it as a Prince song. So then he mentioned that, and then I disbelieved it for some time, and then we had the internet was available.
They invented the internet just to solve this argument.
Thank goodness.
in that case, you were like, oh, well, I'm pretty sure it's originally a Tom Jones song. And I'm like,
I was pretty sure.
I assure you.
That's all I knew.
Well, and the thing is, I can understand that assumption, Tom Jones having had a career, you know, 30 years pre-Prince. Yeah. That seems the logical assumption.
Yeah.
And he had, you know, he absolutely had a hit with that song. It's not like it was like, oh, the little known Tom Jones cover of Kiss.
Right, right.
Like,
yeah, it was. Yeah, now that you mentioned it, it was all over MTV.
It was a well-known, you know, cover. So it's not absolutely unbelievable that you would think that. It was just, you know, I'm enough of a Prince fan that I was just like, yeah. I can absolutely assure you that I know for sure that, you know, Prince wrote this song because I'm a huge Prince fan. And so I was certain that time. And that was the first
time. Have you heard the Prince version before?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, did you have like a CD or something of this with the song on it? Or how did you know?
It was a massive hit.
Like, oh, Prince's hit was big before Prince's Tom Jones.
Hit, Prince's yeah. hit was much okay. bigger than Tom Jones. Like the fact that you didn't know it, like see, even now, like, you know, the fact that you didn't know it is just this weird gap that I assume you were off planet for 2 years.
Yeah, I don't know how I didn't know that, because, yeah, now it's, yeah. I mean, I hear, yeah, yeah. There's so much Prince in that song.
It's on the soundtrack to Under the Cherry Moon, which is one of my favorite movies. Okay. But also,
so Prince actually put it out before Tom Jones did.
Considerably.
Okay.
It yeah. is, yeah, massive hit. And it's, and you know, and not only is it on a hit, as you know, Under the Cherry Moon is one of my favorite movies. We did an episode yeah, that's of this from, show what, about Under the Cherry
Moon. The late 80s?
Yeah, it's a, you know, it is a very important song, you know. So it's, I mean, important in what? That, like, it was a big hit of his, and I enjoyed it. And but the point is, and, I mean, I'm actually not making fun of Stephanie here. I
yeah.
probably will again well, on the episode.
It's okay.
But at this point, it's just like I think that's one of those weird spots where if you didn't encounter, because yeah. Again, you were clear.
Yeah, I had never seen the movie so, The Cherry Moon.
Not at so, that point. But also, point. If, you were, if you have seen it, if we've yeah. watched it since then. If you hadn't encountered it, you could be like, I guess you could just miss it.
I think that speaks to you. Any of us. I mean, the first time we hear something, if it's new to you, it's new to you. If you don't know mm-hmm. the history of something. And I think there's a lot of that. I mean, if there's a lot of years separating covers, it makes sense. That one's a little strange because there's, you know, what year did the Tom Jones song come out? Because that, you know, there's not a lot of gap there.
Yeah.
It just, that was marketed to a very different audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. My first conscious memory of experiencing that is, you know, when I was early teens, first listening to radio on my own, the song The Locomotion came on. And mm-hmm. that was just part of the soundtrack for me. And at the time, the version I knew was Grand Funk Railroad. And I don't suppose I knew it was a song by Little Eva from 10 years prior to that for another 10, 15, 20 years.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, wasn't listening to a whole lot of soul, but down in the holler.
You just not being exposed to it. So when I, you know, discovered there was another version of it, that was surprising to me. And there's that's 10
years difference now?
I'm not sure what year Little Eva's version came out. Okay. But Grand Funk was like 1971, 72. Little Eva was probably 61, 62.
Okay, Prince was 86 and Tom Jones was 88. So just 2 years.
Yeah.
Oh.
And just and very different radio markets. Mm-hmm. By the time I'm listening to radio, Little Eva is not being played on the radio probably absolutely, anywhere. Yeah.
10-year difference is huge. Sure.
Yeah.
One of the other examples I can think of from the 80s, once again, heard this song and didn't know it was a cover for years. Is Soft Cell's Tainted Love, which originally recorded by Gloria Jones. Once again, another soul artist. And had no idea that.
So how similar is the original to the Soft Cell version?
Really very similar. I mean, Soft Cell adds you know, a lot more in the way of electronic and that sort of thing. But lyrically, the tone of it is very similar. Not a lot of radical differences. And that's another one of the things with cover songs is that we can get into is reasons for doing it. If you do one, do you do a straight cover or, you know, or do you radically change it? I mean, there are songs that, you know, Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower is
right.
far more famous than Bob Dylan's version. Yes. They're both famous. But you know, Dylan's came different. First and very different. And yeah, Dylan wrote it, but I think most people and possibly even Bob Dylan would say Jimi Hendrix's version is the definitive version.
I believe Dylan.
Yeah, I think he did say
said that. Hendrix's version is better. I believe that's a quote somewhere. That and I'm not positive, but like I actually think that Dylan is on record as saying Jimmy did a better version of the song of that specific song. Yes.
So and then you know just things. So and there are some that are just straight up. This is a cover tune, and see some of that is just things are marketed for different audiences. I'm jumping around here. Reasons behind it. Back in the earliest days of music publishing, music recording, it's the music publishers who own the rights to it. And when there was
country radio and soul radio and rock radio, you would have different artists record different versions of the song to sell it to different audiences. It just increased your sales. You know, it wasn't necessarily associated with this specific artist. You know, certainly the you know, 1950s, there was a whole lot of, oh, this is by a black artist. This is a really cool song, but we can't play that on a white station. Let's get Elvis to record it. Or Pat Boone, or whoever.
With his covers of Tutti Frutti from Little Richard. Little Richard just had his music. And he was...
Pat Boone covered that?
Yeah.
And, I can just imagine.
Well, Little Richard bitter a lot about... Like, later...
Did he like what Pat Boone, how Pat Boone heard it? Wouldn't imagine.
No. Little Richard hated that his music, his very black, very gay music, was constantly being stolen by, you know, white guys to just do weird, soulless pop versions.
Meaningless.
So hooking up with like a transvestite like drag queen in like a closet, like the songs are
We couldn't have that on white.
And Pat Boone made it bubblegum pop. And some of that, once again, it's the publishers own the rights to it. Little Richard probably didn't own the rights to his music at that time. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the way the music industry works is anybody can do a cover of anything. The three of us can form a band this afternoon, record our version of the Rolling Stones Satisfaction, and put it out. We don't have to get their approval to release that song on a record. We do have to pay them residuals.
Yes. I don't know exactly how it works, but my understanding is there is something to that effect. Like, it's actually hard to... I mean, I guess maybe it's different if you, I don't understand the, we didn't get a lawyer this show, this kind of thing where I wish Hannah's boyfriend was around, Josh was around as our legal expert to explain these things to us. But my understanding is it's things like, there's publishing rights and there's reproduction rights. So what I can't do is I can go out right now, just like you have, because Stephanie plays piano. I can go out right now and I can buy a book full of Bob Dylan songs, and I can sit down on the piano and play Bob Dylan songs. Mm-hmm. I can go out and do a cover of Bob Dylan songs at if I got a gig tonight or whatever. Like, those are things that I can do. But what I can't do is take Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower and just toss it in a movie without his permission.
Right, or take samples from it, like Kanye West or someone like that.
That becomes weird because you actually sort of can and you sort of can't. It depends on how much you do. And it's like that becomes all kinds of weird. But you're supposed to pay for stuff like that, pay for samples and stuff.
I don't know exactly how you
go to.
Yeah, because you're using the actual work of someone else in those cases. Recording. Right.
But I know that they do go to artists for samples. Right. And so that doesn't mean that.
Well, I'm not sure they go to the artist or they go to the public.
Some people they've talked about going to the actual artist.
Yeah, but
staying.
It depends on who owns it, is what I'm getting at.
Right. It depends on who owns it.
Yeah, I don't understand the particulars of that. Please don't take this as definitive, anybody who's listening, because I'm not.
Publishing rights, owning the publishing rights, and songwriters are owning the publishing rights, and that varies from band to band.
My question was, though, so if you do want to sample someone's song and you ask the person, whoever owns it, and then you get permission from that person, you still have to pay them, or do you, can they say, oh, okay. So it doesn't
Well, I imagine they could say you, I imagine they could give you permission to sample it free of charge if they wanted to, but one would presume that they would say, yes, you can use the sample for 1% of the grocers. Mm-hmm. That's what I would do.
And there are times it's cheaper to re-record something than it is to actually use it. I just, within the last few years I don't know if it was the NFL, if it was college football or whatever, but they wanted to use the song, the Queen song, We Are the Champions, because of course they do. You know, that's this giant sports theme these days.
Absolutely.
They wanted to use that for Saturday afternoon football, whatever. And to pay Queen to use it was exorbitant, because of course it is. They hired the band The Struts, who are sort of a modern glam band, and the singer sounds a lot like Freddie, to re-record it. Now they had to pay Queen... Enough. Yeah, no, they had to pay Queen to use the song, residuals for the song, but they didn't have to pay them as much as actually licensing the song.
Mm-hmm. It was cheaper. Yeah, that makes sense.
It was cheaper to hire another band to re-record it than it was to license the actual song.
I mean, you also have, and a similar thing, like right now that's going on is Taylor Swift owns the publishing rights to the songs that she's written. Like she owns the, so she owns the, you know, like if you want to cover a Taylor Swift song, then you buy the, you know, you pay her for that. But she does not own the publishing rights to her early albums. So the actual recordings of her voice. So Taylor's, so what she's done is all of Taylor's early albums, I don't remember how many of them, she's recorded them all twice. So in the last 2 years, she has re-released all of her early albums. Of like, so she's got two versions of her first album, one that she recorded when she was 16 or whatever, and one that she recorded when she was like 30. And it's just like she's just basically doing covers of old Taylor Swift songs so that like there are modern versions that she can own. And because of that, consequently, it's the reason why Taylor Swift is the only person who has ever had all 10 slots on the top 10 list at one time.
Yeah, and that's why.
She had just re-released all the albums.
Oh, okay, I did not know she did that.
Yeah, she released
new versions of the albums, which is technically different than re-release the albums.
Well, it's technically a cover. What it is, it's 34-year-old Taylor Swift covering 18-year-old.
So did she change any of the lyrics?
No, well, maybe, but like for the most part, there she's trying. The intention wasn't to do that. The intention was. She knows her fans love her enough that they will just use the new version rather than the old one because she because they would rather her get the money than her old label. Taylor has that power.
Yeah, and that publishing thing. I mean, it was in the news just within the last year. John Fogerty, who was the lead singer and songwriter of Creedence Clearwater Revival, hadn't seen a dime off Creedence Clearwater Revival songs in 50 years. And just got the catalog back, say, within the last year, where he's making money from it and can license it and sell it and that sort of thing. So, yeah, say it gets really weird in terms of who owns what and what rights are there.
And
going back to Queen for a Queen for a second, they had, when they started as a band, each individual songwriter would get the publishing rights, you know, creator's rights, whatever, to the songs they wrote. It wasn't all credited just to Queen. And this happens in a lot of bands. You have one person in the band who is the primary songwriter who ends up making tons more money than the drummer, which leads to all kinds of problems in the band because one guy is filthy rich and the rest of the people just start feeling like employees. But if he's the songwriter, you know, it makes sense. Where Queen made a deal where they would do that. What separated them is every one of them was a songwriter and every one of them eventually had a top 10 hit. So each one of them made a ton of money off of songs that were released.
So far Taylor Swift has re-recorded four of her early albums. So she's got, so there's an album called Fearless and there's another that was released in 2008 and there's an album called Fearless Taylor's Version came out in 2021.
One with asterisks.
There's an album called Red which came out in 2012 and there's Red Taylor's Version it comes out in 2021. Speak Now is 2010. Speak Now Taylor's Version 2023. Okay. 1989 came out in 2014. 1989 Taylor's Version 2023, and they are essentially, you know, re-recordings of all the albums. Like, there's I'm sure there's minor differences, but like they exist for her to own control of her music. And I think, and if I understand it correctly, it's a big impetus for the Eras tour that she's on now. Is like a lot of it is her performing. It, like, she goes through costume changes during the concert to where, you know, here's me dressing like I did in 2008, singing my 2008 songs. Now I'm going to go off stage and come back and be in my 2010 outfits, you know. And so you get to see her grow up on stage is like sort of the concept of the current tour.
Well, and that the way people make money, I mean, they're going back to Hendrix. Hendrix just famously would sign any piece of paper that went in front of him. So his publishing rights, creator's rights, whatever. When he died, apparently it was just a nightmare to sort that out because, you know, it'd be three or four different music publishers all claiming the rights to the same song. And by God, there's a signature. Because he had no idea. And that's the problem. You know, so many people go into the business and not understanding how the business works. And, you know, we have this in comics as well. People who
do this work for years, but don't own the rights to any of the things mm-hmm. they've produced. And that's just, you know, one of the, you know, stories of the arts, unfortunately. And then there are ways around that. Once again, using one of my examples, the band The Sweet, that people know from Ballroom Blitz and Fox on the Run, in their earliest days, and their biggest hits in Great Britain in the early 70s, they had like 13 top 10 hits, which...
Really?
Most of which are songs nobody in America knows. But they were...
That's why I'm like, really?
They were remarkably successful in Great Britain and Europe, and they all made a ton of money. But part of that was there was a songwriting team in Great Britain at the time, Chen and Chapman, who wrote hit songs for everybody recording in England at that time.
Okay.
That's a bit of an exaggeration, but not much. That they had their finger on the pulse of what was going on with the teeny bopper crowd at that time. They were writing songs for band after band, and they owned the rights to the songs. So the band would record it. They would get a modicum income from it, whatever. But Chen and Chapman were the people who made most of the money off of it. Unlike a lot of those bands, the guys in Sweet were actually pretty decent musicians and pretty decent songwriters. They made a deal where Chen and Chapman, they would record a Chen and Chapman song for the A side of a single, but they had a deal where they got the B side. So all the B sides of the Sweet singles were written by the guys in Sweet. So when the A side became a top 10 hit, they still were able to receive residuals for selling the B side, which is on that. People weren't buying it for the B side, but they were buying that song. So right,
because it doesn't matter because you can't tell. You don't know what side they're buying it for.
Right, right. So the loophole is they made a lot of money off sales of these singles, even though technically people were buying them for the A-sides. So there was a time those guys made a lot of money through B-sides. And then they would put on concerts and they'd be playing all. And their B-sides were in general harder rocking songs. They wanted to beat Deep Purple. And Chen Chapman mm-hmm. wanted them to be bubblegum pop. And they would play concerts and all the bubblegum pop fans would show up and they're doing these hard rock songs. Like, what the?
Yeah. They actually wrote themselves.
The first one that they wrote themselves that became a hit was Fox on the Run.
Oh, okay.
And then Love is Like Oxygen later became mm-hmm. a really pretty big hit around 1977. So that was a loophole through it. A lot of times cover songs. So, there are those reasons for doing it. There's also a lot of bands will be under contract with a company. When I say band, I just solo artists, whatever.
Yeah.
They'll be under contract for here. Yeah. We have signed to do X amount of albums, mm-hmm. but we don't like our contract and we're getting out of it, but we still owe this company an album. Mm-hmm. Let's give them an album full of covers. We're writing new songs, but we don't want to give it to them.
We don't want to give them our songs. Yes. Mm hmm.
So Bowie famously released an album called Pinups that I believe was done under that thing. And it was just like, hey, these are some of my favorite songs from the 60s that influenced me. And yes, I'm writing Diamond Dogs, but you don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Prince famously got out of his contract with Warner Brothers by, they were like, you can do whatever you want, but we got you locked up for 8 more albums. So good luck, mm-hmm. buddy. And he's 8 more albums. 2 years.
Seriously, how did his lawyers let him sign that contract?
He was 17.
Oh,
yeah.
He was 17 and he signs like a he signs like a 15 or 20 album deal or something like that.
That sounds good when you're 17.
And no one had ever heard of him. He was nobody.
Right.
Like they were just they basically said, "Wow, you are nobody, but you are clearly the most talented individual we've ever heard of, and you're this poor, random kid from Minneapolis. Sure, we'll give you a 20-album deal.
Yeah, how can we most efficiently take advantage of you?
Right, and that sounds great because you're like, I'm a poor, random kid from Minneapolis. Yeah, I'll work forever. And then, like, you become, a bajillionaire, and you're like, I don't like these people anymore. I would really like to do my own thing.
It should be illegal to have that kind of contract.
Turns out it wasn't.
Yeah, it's like, it is, like he said, like slavery almost.
Well, he did.
That
was the thing. They were like, well, you can't be Prince because we've copyrighted the character of Prince. And he's like, but that's my name. It's like, no, you're
literally his name.
His name is Prince Rogers Nelson. Yep. And so his first name was Prince. Mm-hmm. So hence the changing his name to a symbol and writing the word slave on his face for 2 years where he wandered around just calling himself a slave. They couldn't force him to promote any of his albums. So there's like a 2-year period where he releases 8 albums in like 2 years, 3 years. And a lot of them, they're not the best Prince albums. Some of them, there's some interesting songs on them, but there are also some, yeah, I'm just going to pump through some songs. I'm going to release an album every 3 months. And yeah. And then like when he's done, like he literally just kind of burns through songs, like, you know, these, all these CDs, like Let It Go has 12 tracks on it, I think. And like the one of the tracks, one of my favorite tracks is just on this album, is just, it's literally just 3 minutes of him having sex. Like, it's just like, I mean, it's not good. It's not interesting. It's a bed creaking and people moaning. And
oh, like, so no actual music.
No. It's called Come. It's like, it's literally just like an orgasm. No, there's no music. It's not a, there's music videos that are just the lyrics over like black and footage, because he didn't want to write videos for them. It's like, I don't have a contract to do music videos for you. I have a contract to record albums for you. And so he records like a bunch of albums in like a 2 year period and just releases them without promotion, without concerts, without anything. And then he gets through the contract in like a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, he releases under his own label, he releases Emancipation, which I believe is a 4-album set. Like a 4-CD album. Because like, he was working on it all along, and it was just literally like, all right, I'm just going to record a bunch of crap songs, and while I'm doing this, I will record my good songs for this album over here that I want to do. And that's just how people get out of contracts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
live albums serve that purpose as well.
Yeah,
yeah. If you are a live album,
right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. This requires you being prolific enough to be able to record, you know, that many songs,
and it rarely happens where people have 8 albums left under the contract. It's usually because no one would
sign you to a contract that long.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And certainly not anymore. They wouldn't. But live albums serve that purpose a lot as well. Just like you. Mm-hmm. Okay, we recorded this on the road. Here's your album. All right, bye.
I think one of Prince's albums for Warner Brothers is literally the soundtrack to Girl 6, which is a Spike Lee movie. And it's got, he recorded all the songs, but like, I can't remember how many songs, but most of them are songs that were previously recorded. There's like 2 new songs on the album, and it's all, and otherwise it's just all old songs. And he's like, that's an album.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and there's also that whole thing of, you know, with stuff being covers, you know, things we don't realize are covers when we hear them. People whose signature song is not original to them, you know, Aretha Franklin's Respect.
Redding. Yes, yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Otis Redding. Joan Jett, Girls, I Love Rock and Roll.
Yeah, Girls Just Want to Have Fun by Cindy Lauper.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Manic Monday for
written by a man.
Manic Monday is a Prince song that Prince did several, because Manic Monday was a Prince song that he knew he wasn't as good at. So he's like, oh, how about you guys?
They did a
much better job on that. And Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You is a Prince song that he's like, that Prince says that Sinead O'Connor's solo version is better than his own solo version.
Yeah.
He could never make it work for himself. And then he's like, oh, wait, no, I've got one. And then his version with Rosie Gaines is my favorite version of that song.
For Manic Monday, it's just like, I just can't imagine like Prince having a 9-to-5 job. Not so much the Bangles either, but more so than Prince. So yeah. I don't know if that has anything to do with why the cover was more successful.
You can imagine them working at an In-N-Out Burger before they became famous, right?
The Prince, he sleeps until like 1 o'clock and, you know. Is up until 4 o'clock in the morning.
Writes an album.
I don't think that's inaccurate, actually.
Yeah, so maybe they just like had more of a, like, I don't know, more connection to the song.
Yeah, I mean, he felt it was more authentic, right? Like, yeah. I don't know, it's just. Mm-hmm. I want to see what people thought about this is most recently like the one that comes to mind is the song "Fast Car." Originally by Tracy Chapman, recently re-released by Luke Combs as a country song, to which there was initially some backlash from people who were like, ew, what, you know, it's like some people were like, well, this, you know, another white guy trying to steal the song of the black lesbian. And Luke Combs is like, my favorite song, man. It's a good song. I'm not pretending I wrote it.
Yeah, right.
I love Tracy Chapman. And then she's like honored, and suddenly they're both on the charts at the same time.
Yeah.
And then he...
Oh, so her version was on the charts at the same time. His yeah. was, is what you're saying?
Her version, yeah. Her version returned to the okay, chart. Because yeah. she version in 1988.
Yeah, yeah, in 1988. And his version came out last year, 2023. Mm-hmm. So her version like returned to the charts. And then they end up performing it together at CMAs or the Oreo Grammys. I can't remember which
I thought it was Country Music Awards.
Okay. Yeah. He brings her out and they perform it together, which is kind of awesome. And, you know?
Yeah. And that is, that's a great way to make people aware of old music. I mean, you know, this is how many people in his demographic were even born in 1988. You know, like there's old stuff you never hear. There's so much out there you can't be aware of all that stuff.
No, Luke Combs wasn't even born in 1988.
Oh God,
Luke Combs was born in 1990. Yeah. I was like, you said that, and I'm like, he's a young looking dude. He's actually older than I thought he was. I thought he was in his 20s. He's 34. So like, he wasn't even born. He just loves the song. He's just like, it's a great song.
Well, and I think, and that's it. Reasons for recording a song. I mean, I think a lot of it just boils down to, I love this song. This was a big influence on me. I want to do my version of it. I think, you know, a lot of times it's just purely out of tribute. It's not a calculated, I'm going to make money off of this. It's a, man, I love that song. I want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
That's good. Isn't that what music should be about, right?
Oh, yeah, what I've heard, his version is very similar to the original version.
Yeah.
Well, he's not, I mean, it's similar, but I think it's a true cover, right? Like, it's not a reinterpretation. I think he loves the song and he wanted to do, you know, he just wanted to do it.
He twangs it up a bit more for his audience. But it's a very, I think true is a good way of putting it. Respectful to the original cover, not the things that are radical reinterpretations are necessarily disrespectful either. But yeah, there are things like Devo recorded the Stone Satisfaction, and you know it's radically different, and it was meant to be. It was meant to show how you can do these radical reinterpretations of things. The Butthole Surfers did a cover of American Woman that is unrecognizable to the original. And, you know, is that done out of respect? Is that done out of just an artistic need to deconstruct? You know, who knows? And does it matter? There's also, there's so many old songs. Like, you know, in the earliest days of the recording industry, you know, so much of those songs were, they were folk songs. They were traditional songs that had been passed down through an oral tradition that eventually got recorded. And no one knows the origin of it. You know, we have... But there are also things like, you know, the Great American Songbook. Like, we know Irving Berlin wrote this, but how many hundred people have recorded it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so, that's true. So there's a lot of that sort of thing. You know, like, no one associates the song as, oh, the original artist. It's very much, oh, this song. No matter who does it.
You know,
I think when you're talking about that, though, you have this other thing where people... I don't think for most people, I know Stephanie's gonna disagree here because I know what she likes, but I don't think most people care about who wrote a song, which is to say, I think there are a lot of songs, like Stephanie even said, well, what about the songs they wrote themselves? But I think that for the vast majority of popular music, you have a songwriter who is a different person than the recording artist, right? Like most professional singers don't write their own music.
That changed a lot with rock and roll. I mean, it sort of became the expected that people wrote their own music.
So what you end up with, though, like you end up with, like you said, you've got people. I mean, famously, Sia was just writing music.
Yeah, I guess in my opinion, I feel like writing the music is the Well, it's really the seed. Come on. I mean, it's the, like, you have to be you have to have skill, a lot of skill and knowledge. And it's something hard to do. I've tried to write music myself. I can sing perfectly fine, but writing music is hard. And I really respect the writing of the song. So that's why I'm always interested in who is actually written.
I'm aware you feel that way. But I'm saying, I think for a lot of people, that's not the case, right? Yeah. Like when you talk about Aretha Franklin not writing Respect, or Manilow doesn't write I Write the Songs.
It was about music is who is referring to in that song.
Yeah.
So. I know, but I'm saying his signature song, like It's easily his biggest hit is I Write the Songs. It's the one most associated with him. And it's called I Write the Songs. And yet he didn't write it. So I think that I'm not complaining about Barry Manilow. I'm saying that, that becomes like a, you know, he's known for it. Just like Hendrix is known for Watchtower, like Aretha's known for Respect. And I think that there is a sense of what is associated as the urtext, as the truth copy in somebody's head of the general populace. I think we sort of denigrate. It's why people were like, oh, Luke Combs is, how dare he cover Tracy Chapman? And she didn't care. She was honored. She said so, right? She performed that. And the one that I always remember, because I always thought it was fascinating, is there's a song called I Swear. I Swear was a song written by Gary Baker and Frank Myers. And they wrote it and they released it. It comes out in 1993 by a country singer named John Michael Montgomery. He releases it in November of 1993. It has a little bit of success, but not great. And then it later, early in the next year, in April of 94, this R&B group, All For One, four guys, they release an R&B version of the same song. And like, there's a synergy to where both versions of I Swear are then charting in 94. Like they, and like, you, so you've got Montgomery's version on the country charts at the same time as All For One's version is on the R&B charts. And I think both of their fans thought that the other group was stealing their music.
Yes, and, right. Right.
They weren't. Why, like, they just both bought a song from the same songwriter. And they've since recorded versions of it together. You can find on YouTube.
But then people discover that and kind of opens up like a new kind of almost like a new world to them when you discover that.
If, for the people who did, which I don't think is most people.
Oh, by the way, so for getting back to I Write the Songs, you kind of rung a bell and I was trying to remember. So originally, like, David Cassidy, of all people, put out I Write the Songs.
Really?
And, listen to his version, and you will understand why shortly after that Barry Manilow put out.
I remember replaying it, I do remember replaying it.
It's pretty.
I'll have to look for that. That's funny. Well, and I think, most people, particularly if you're just listening to music. I mean, I'm, unadulterated fanboy for music. I read way too much about it. I delve into it far more than I think a lot of people do, just as a hobby and obsession. I think, most people don't give a whole lot of consideration to the difference between who writes it and who sings it. They just hear a song by Sting, or anybody. And I think, modern music, I think there's a lot of truth to that. But, the songwriting tradition, I mean, in New York throughout, I don't even know when it started, but way back, there was the Brill Building. And the Brill Building was full of people who wrote songs for the publishing companies, for the record companies. And then those songs would be farmed out to whoever hot artist of the moment was. There were tons of people who had a significant career as a songwriter with massive hits for other artists. Some of them never recorded on their own. No one ever knew who they were. Some of them went on to quite a bit of fame. Carole King worked in the Brill Building before she became Carole King. And she's one of the most famous examples of that. But there's just so much of it being produced. I mean, that was almost a factory-like setting for writing music. You went to work every day, you sat down, you wrote music, and Herman's Hermits would record it. And you didn't get any thought to
it. Yeah, it just seems like it's really unfair to the writers that they... Mm-hmm. I mean, just by the nature, you're going to know who actually is singing it.
So I'm curious.
I just feel like they should be done to really publicize who is actually, who's behind it.
So I'm curious, so when you say that, yes, I understand your point you're making, but my understanding of what you being specifically Stephanie Seiler, like you specifically, you, not like people, but you and specifically, when you're saying who actually wrote it, you mean the lyricist, right?
I mean both.
Okay.
I'm actually probably more interested in who composed the music.
Okay, because I'm thinking of somebody like Rick Rubin, music producer Rick Rubin, who has a bajillion hits. Rick Rubin is not starving. I think he's famous enough that probably people know his name. but also Rick Rubin, I think, doesn't give a damn if you know who he is or not, because he's got like $1 billion. Yeah. And he has
respect from within the industry.
Yes. But I don't think most people, sit down and they say, I'm listening to a Rick Rubin song. No. They sit down and they say, I'm listening to Metallica or the Dixie Chicks or Johnny Cash or Public Enemy, LRL. Like, because he literally produced for everyone in every genre. He wrote everybody's music for, you know, like 3 decades. He just like has just for like 30 years, he's just worked with everybody to where he is arguably, you know, the biggest, the most, he calls himself a producer, but I'd say he is one of the most successful music creatives, you know, songwriters who ever, like, probably near Mozart level, right? As the number of as the amount of music that he has actually created himself. But how many things has he sung lead on? Zero, right? Like, there are no Rick Rubin albums.
And also, the who wrote the music gets complicated, particularly in the studio, because you'll have someone come in with
jam session.
I'm going to go back to Queen. You know, Freddie would come in with a piano bit and some lyrics, and then John Deacon would come up with the bass part in the studio, and Brian May would develop the guitar solo in the studio. And at the end of the day, Freddie Mercury gets the songwriting credit because he brought it in. But in terms of the music, it was the band, and it happened in the studio at the moment. And, you know, you watch that 80-hour-long Beatles documentary from a year or so ago, and you watch them doing that. So it gets complicated to break down exactly who did what.
Well, that one in particular, like, if you just look at the labels, you would presume that Lennon and McCartney were musical geniuses, and Harrison and Ringo were idiots. And that's just not true. Like, I mean, Ringo's entire image is that he is an idiot, and he's not. Arguably, he is. I mean, he's not. He's a musical genius who structured and made, because he's in charge of the beat, he made every single one of those songs for the entire decade that the Beatles were recording together, right? Like, that's just, they don't work without, you know, because, and it's very clear, because he's not the original drummer. And if and they're lucky they got it, right? Because they would not have been the Beatles without.
You know. And he gets songwriting credits for Octopus's Garden, you know.
Yes, for literally one song that no one cares about.
I mean, there are probably some others on.
Yellow Submarine.
And there are probably a couple of others, but the point being, you know, the sound of that band was all four of them. But if you just look at the songwriting credits, that's not indicated. And that's true for, you know, any band that works in concert like that. And by in concert, I mean working together, not having a concert. You know, so much of that just happens spur of the moment in the studio. And it's a organic structuring kind of thing. Like, very rarely did someone come in and with, here's the bass part that I wrote last night. I'm sure that happens.
And we're done. we just released the song. It's just all bass, baby.
and I'm sure that happens somewhere. But so the writing, particularly for bands and in studio situations where you have multiple musicians, it's far more complex than just saying this person wrote it. And that gets into the problems of who owns the rights and publishing and who gets paid and who gets the money and all that sort of thing.
And it's every creative industry, right? Like, you know, we talk about films. We talk about a great film performance. It's really easy to say somebody acted their ass off or not. But like everything else, people talk about, like, well, the vision of this film was the director. Was it though? I mean, sure, to an extent, like, Spielberg's a genius. Scorsese's a genius. But they're not cinematographers. And for the most part, you know, like a lot of the work happens from... The cinematography is in the hands of another person. If Monica was here, she'd point out costumes. Costumes make Poor Things, which just, you know, won a bunch of Oscars, right? Is not the film that it is if they're just wearing jeans, Someone made decisions that person that made decisions is not the director, and it's not even really the producer. And and it's easy to even point out the ones that we give Oscars for, but decisions are being made by a guy holding a light.
Yeah. And but it's just like when you go to a movie, like at the end, there's the credits and you can see all the people that were involved in production.
They do that in the
audience. When you're listening to a song on the radio, all you know is maybe the artist.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, if you buy the CD, which no one does anymore, I get that, I mean, you're listening to the radio. You mean Spotify? Is that what you're talking about? Old person?
Yeah, right.
Sure. Sure, you satellite radio.
But if I want to, if I'm on Spotify and I really want to know, then I tap it and it shows me the entire credits.
Okay, when I use Shazam, all it shows me is who... like who the band is who sang it.
I remember you sitting and reading you.
Yes.
Liner notes.
I remember who the band was and liner notes and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that is something that's missing. And not just to make this a whole thing,
but better it's you being a nerd. Days kind of thing.
Yeah, it's me being a nerd, right. You know, like if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have known that Davy Johnstone played guitar for both Alice Cooper and Elton John in the 70s. And nobody knows who the fuck he is. Yeah,
right. I think that ability is there, right? You're right. If I stay in the theater and I watch the rolling credits, I can see who the best boy grip is. But literally, unless it's an Avengers movie, other than me, who do you know who likes to do that?
Yeah, I know. I mean, at least it's there.
Yeah.
But it's there too. It's there for music too, right? Like, you can read liner notes. You can go by, on Spotify because that's easier for you, but it's also easier for you to just get up and walk out of the theater or turn off Netflix the second the plot is over, right? And which is what most people do. Most people don't shrinks the image, it's done. Right.
I was gonna say, the app does that for you. It shrinks the image and wants to take you to the new thing right away.
To the next show, right? And I mean, it's why Marvel movies started doing post-credit scenes, right? Mm-hmm. They're rewarding you for watching the credits by giving you a little sting of, essentially either, one more joke or frankly, a commercial for the next thing, right?
Yeah, non-Marvel movies should do that too.
Well, a lot of them started, right? People started doing that when the MCU picked up on it. But I mean, the same thing happens in, comics, for instance, right? Comics, no one cares about the inker is a long-standing joke, right? All you do is trace, which is not true. But for all the comments that we talk about, for all the criticism that comics fans make of, we need to give more credit to the inker. You know who no one ever says this about? Colorist.
Yep.
The letterer. There are other jobs.
But I can name Tom Wojciechowski and Todd Klein.
Tom Wojciechowski is a brilliant letterer. You've seen his work. You know how I know? Because you've read a comic book in the last 40 years.
But you always know who the writer is of the comic books. Mm. That's always pretty clear.
Yeah.
Usually.
For the first 20 years of the industry. No, you didn't.
Yeah, that was wrong. That was wrong.
Well, So much stuff was not credited back then. I mean, there are comics in existence that to this day
we don't know who wrote to this day. Everybody's dead and no one remembers. So there's I think who wrote them now, but the writing in that same way that Wayne was talking about, with the collaboration, who wrote Fantastic Four in the early days, Wayne? Well, it says Stan Lee. They all say written by Stan Lee, Stan and Jack Kirby, because Stan Lee's idea of writing was in this book, The Fantastic Four Fights Galactus. Okay, Jack, give me 22 pages.
so there was
a lot of that, right? Famously, the Silver Surfer is created because Silver Surfer, longstanding Marvel comic character, is created because Stan basically said, and then Galactus comes down, and Jack just drew this guy in the book, and Stan's like, what's with the guy on the surfboard? And Jack's like, I thought he should have a guy on a surfboard hanging out with him.
Yeah, someone that powerful needs a herald. And Stan went, okay. and wrote dialogue.
But like there, but like literally, it's just, it's 22 pages of, and there's this other guy running around, and then Stan had to decide what he was there for. But like, so he, and so now he is, you know, fast forward 70 years, he's one of Marvel's longest standing characters, but it's literally because Jack Kirby said, I don't know, and there's a guy here, you know.
Like, that's, okay. Right, right,
that's basically,
he fleshed out the idea though,
right? Stan
yeah,
yeah, oh yeah, oh absolutely, yeah. And I think that's, I mean, not to go into the weeds with all that, but yeah, I mean, you know,
sure,
all that the point stuff being, it's collaboration, yeah, it was right. All collaborative, but if you, but just
the writer credited with Stan, with creator, with Silver Surfer is Stan Lee, yeah. The writer credited and with Batman is Bob Kane, and that is true in the most nebulous.
Okay, for me, yeah. Like the reason I care about who the original writer is, I want to hear more of like that kind of music. If I really love a song, I'll look it up, and then I'll find like I said, that kind of like opens a whole new world. Except of that, like,
what do you do when the writer? I mean, so yes, I understand your point,
and I agree, like, with that completely, Steph.
So yeah. Do I. But also, what do you do when you say that kind of music? Right, like if you are,
no,
well, no, because I'm saying if you're Rick Rubin, right, and you say I want to hear more. Like, if you look up a song and you say, see, it was written by Rick Rubin, you're like, okay, I want to hear more music that sounds like that.
Yeah, well, he was, when I was right, he's also a producer. Like, so he does work, like, more directly with artists. But there are also composers who just work more on their own.
Sure.
And then they bring what they found, you know, into the studio. And sure, it's, like, tweaked and stuff, I'm sure. Yeah, but they have, like, a...
I'm the greatest music producer of all time, so it's special. Quincy Jones.
Well, I mentioned that the songwriting duo, Chin and Chapman, in the early 70s, like, bubblegum glam scene. And yeah, you know, if you listen to the songs they wrote for The Sweet, and you listen to the songs they wrote for Suzy Quatro, and you listen to the songs they wrote for Mud, yeah, those are Chin and Chapman songs. any one of those bands could have recorded any one of those songs, and the differences would have been really pretty minor.
Similar people, I'll give you Max Martin.
Yeah,
Max,
the guy who wrote like Britney Spears for a while.
Max Street Boys, and so yeah, I don't know if he did Backstreet Boys, he did anything. He was the bubblegum pop sound of the 1990s, or famously Phil Spector. The wall. Yeah, a wall of sound song sounds like a wall of sound song, and it doesn't matter which of those groups it came from.
Right.
And nor did he particularly care. Hits were just being written, and which group is available.
So, yeah,
was like how that production
apparently drove him crazy.
Yeah, and that's it. We can't deny the music industry business part of this whole thing.
Right.
A lot of that, you know, a lot of the bro building. So many of these places were, you know, sweatshops for music writers. They just it's places where they went in, they labored, they put stuff out. Hopefully, somebody recorded it and they saw some residuals.
Yes, and that's even the successful ones, right? Like, the reason Phil Spector was a name was because Phil Spector was a hit factory. The reason Rubin is a name today is because, you know, being able to make a hit with Metallica or Public Enemy or Johnny Cash, that's a skill. it's like, okay, it doesn't matter who you get. Dixie Chicks, or the Chicks, I guess they just call themselves now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Rick Rubin will just say, what do we got to work with? All right. I guess we're doing a Chili Peppers album today, and that's...
Yeah, right. And him having the vision and the flexibility to be able to produce those albums in ways that appealed to, A, the audience that was the accepted demographic at the time, but then transcending that demographic and finding an audience outside of that, spoke to a lot of his vision and what he was able to bring to that entire process. So, I mean, it's not like Johnny Cash was a new artist in the 1990s. Right. You know, but Johnny Cash had been stupidly successful through a tremendous amount of his life, and then he had 20 years where nobody cared anymore. And then he covers Hurt. And part of that was Rick Rubin saying, if you listen to those, four or five Johnny Cash albums that Rubin produced, there are a lot of covers of more contemporary music, that stuff. Johnny would probably not have chosen himself. Certainly stuff that the Nashville music industry wouldn't have cared about or thought about Johnny Cash doing. And that was very specifically Rick Rubin saying, this guy is a legend. There's a reason he's a legend. People aren't listening to him because they think of him as old country. Let's give him some contemporary songs that is going to draw the attention of people who like Nine Inch Nails. You know, let's have Nick Cave appear on an album. Whose entire early career was, kind of loosely based on Johnny Cash characters.
He also does, I think he does Personal Jesus too, by Depeche Mode.
Yeah, he does Personal, yeah, he does.
Okay, this is the same album that he did both of those on?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he there was like five Rick Rubin produced albums in the 90s, early 2000s by Johnny.
Man Comes Around, hold on a second.
I mean, the first one is, Hurt.
Oh, yes, they are. Okay, because I knew which album yeah. Hurt was on, and Hurt is track 2 on side A, Personal Jesus is track 3 on side B.
Yeah.
So, yes. So, same. So, yeah. It is a lot. There's a lot of covers, you know, because like Wayne's saying, Rubin knew he was onto something and, you know, he was a hit factory and you could do.
Yeah, he had his fan base. So Rubin knew that if he could open up a new.
He's got Bridge Over Troubled Waters on that album, apparently.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Johnny Cash sings that?
With Fiona Apple.
Yeah.
Okay, she sings the Garfunkel part, I guess.
It's Man Comes Around, Hurt, Give My Love to Rose. That's actually okay. Bridge Over Troubled Water. He sings I Hung My Head by Sting. First Time I Ever Saw Your Face. That's a cover. Personal Jesus is a cover. In My Life is a cover. Desperado, which he sings.
Oh, with man, Don, this is a with, really sad album.
With Don, oh, God. Because Johnny Cash was dying.
Yeah.
You know,
the video for Hurt is just heart-wrenching.
Yeah, yes. I know. Yes. I know.
Yeah, I mean, like, that album comes out in 2002, and, you know, he dies a year later, right? Aww. Like, it's a heavy album, and I think that's kind of what it means, because you're talking about, like, I think you're saying one of the things you like about the songwriter is you're like, I want to see what they're bringing to it. But I think music is collaborative, so you're like.
But I think of the songwriter as the foundational.
I'm not sure I do. Well, I mean, I do, but I understand your point. But I also think that Trent Reznor's version of Hurt and Johnny Cash's version of Hurt are two entirely different songs that just so happen to have the same lyrics. I mean, they are. I've heard, and I have nothing. There's no complaints I'm making about Reznor's version about the number of Hurt. That song. To me, the definitive version of that song is the Cash version, and in particular, that video. And I might also say that it might be my favorite Johnny Cash song. Is like, there's just so much emotion coming from that to where it really feels like this is it's a collaboration with Trent Reznor that Trent Reznor didn't know he was doing at the time, right? Yeah, he didn't know that one day Johnny Cash was going to sing a song.
Because, Johnny's voice, and if you know anything about Johnny Cash, his life experience, I mean, those lyrics, those words coming from an old man who has had his life changes what that song means.
Right.
Even though it's the same words, the meaning feels completely different.
An old man who has less than 12 months to live. Right?
Yeah. And he looks like it. Yeah. I'm not sure when he dies. He did. I mean, that was on the first album they did. And
he dies
did
in 2003. Okay. He dies in 2003. And the Hurt cover comes out in 2002. It's released in November 5th, 2002. And he dies September 12th, 2003. So,
then that wasn't their first collaboration then. Because he did like 4 or 5 albums with Rubin.
Oh, with Rubin. Yeah. That's on the 4th Rubin album.
Okay.
It's on the last one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think his wife June died before he. Yeah, his wife June died before he did.
Yes,
4 months earlier.
And she's in that. Yeah, and June, you know, is the daughter of Maybelle Carter of the Carter family, who was one of the earliest country recording artists who were recording all these old classic songs that nobody knew who wrote them.
He's pretty young too. He was only 71. I thought he looked older than that.
Yeah, but he's clearly he's on his last legs, and he knows.
He had diabetes.
Yeah. And that's what makes it, that's what makes that song work. And I think that, the point I'm making, I think, is there is the fact that it is a cover. I think people use cover like it's a bad word, like, well, you're just copying. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's copying. I'm saying, like, I don't think it's, like, even when we talk about Luke Combs, right? Luke Combs's version of Fast Car is remarkably faithful. Mm-hmm. Cash's version of Hurt is not. It's a different song. Yeah. I mean, to me at least. And I would argue, like, I think Sinead O'Connor's version of Nothing Compares to You, which is technically a cover of a Prince song, is superior to Prince's original recording. and very different. And yet, I think that the Prince and Rosie Gaines version, for me, is superior to that. But I don't feel like they're the same song, other than the fact that they happen to have the same lyrics. Like, it would be weird to mix them together when I listen to the Sinead version versus the NPG version.
Yeah, people just have different ways of emotionally connecting to a specific song. And I think that, that Sinead, she clearly, for some reason, could connect to that song, and she really brought out.
And the radically different versions. I mean, say the Stone Satisfaction and D-Rose version of it. Same lyrics. Mm-hmm. So yeah, same song, kinda, but radically different. So and I think so we resolve nothing. I don't know where we're going with this.
I mean, I completely have respect for I think songwriters are not given as much respect as they really should get. But I also do have respect for people that are able to take a song and then kind of reinterpret it with their background and imparting their meaning to the song and making it a completely new and oftentimes much I mean, depending on, your opinion. Better song.
I know a bunch of Prince ones, and I think for one thing, Prince wrote so much music. It's
easy. Could he really emotionally relate deeply to everything he wrote so much?
There's an awesome song that I love by Prince called "If I Was Your Girlfriend," and then there's a cover of it that is by TLC, they are radically different. They have now. Prince had a high enough voice that it's similar in sound, and they have a relatively faithful cover. Like, they don't really musically reinterpret it or anything. They mostly just sing it. But the Prince song is about if I was your girlfriend, as in your non-romantic, as in he's singing to his girlfriend. If I was your girlfriend rather than your boyfriend, would you tell me different secrets it's literally saying it's a hey, you're treating me differently because we are romantically involved than
there's more of a wall
than there would be with your friends. That's what Prince's song is about. If I was your girlfriend, would you remember to tell me all the things that you forgot to tell me when I was your man, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, if I was your best friend, would you tell me? So that's what the song's about, right? But the TLC version comes across the exact opposite, right? If I, because they're singing, if I was your girlfriend, they're singing to a man, if I was your girlfriend, would you talk to me differently than you do when you just see me as one of the guys? Mm-hmm. Right?
So it's almost conceptually, it's a very
literally just changing the gender and making it a group versus a single individual. Mm-hmm. Like, it completely reverses the feeling and the vibe between, I mean, with the presumption of heterosexuality in both groups, given the lyrics of the song, it just reverses the feeling of what those songs are. And they land differently. And I've listened to them back to back before, and they don't feel like, they just don't, even though they're musically identical and they are lyrically identical, and you go, oh, yeah, I guess those are the same song. It is odd, right? I think there's another one's covers that I like are the song Killing Me Softly. There's Roberta Flack's version. There's the Fugees version. And they're very different. And I also there's a version by, I think I'll Be Sure, where he changes it and he just gender swaps it. And he says, Killing Me Softly with her song rather than his song. But they all feel very unique. There are three versions that are R&B soul, all three of them. And yet they all feel like unique songs because each artist sort of puts their own emotion into it. And they're singing, they're clearly all drawing on some experience they've individually had in order to sing that song. But I think there's value in them.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, yeah. I totally agree. And just another thing I like about covers, just real quick, is you can sometimes you can't understand what they're saying in the original version, and then the cover allows you to. I feel like I understand that he's generally understandable.
How do we get Bob Dylan on the show? Thanks, Bob.
Bob Dylan.
Thanks for showing up. Thanks for showing up to our show, unlike a lot of your concerts.
It like, was not understandable, well, it was not.
Well, I think right. doing that thing, like if you discover that something is a cover song, you go back to the original. I think just in general,
yeah, it opens up
your world to different music and different versions of things. Mm-hmm. When I discover that stuff and you hear where it comes from and you hear the different versions, and to me, it makes the whole experience richer. Mm-hmm. Whether I like the newer version as well or not, sometimes I go back to the original and find it. One of the examples of that is Quiet Riot hit in the early 80s. And I was not into the hair metal thing at the time. I've gone back and been able to reclaim some of that stuff. But that was a point where I was moving off into alternative and college rock and new wave and all that stuff. And, you know, two of their biggest hits, Mama, We're All Crazy Now and Come On, Feel the Noise, are covers of a glam band called Slade. And yeah, and you know, I mean, everybody associates that with Quiet Riot, but much like Sweet, was one of the top selling glam bands in Great Britain in the early 70s. And you go back and you listen to Slade albums, and what you hear is, oh, this is where hair metal from the 80s started. Just like, yep, this is where it came from. Those two songs, very specifically, but that sound here, 1972.
It was just like a cleaner sound that Quiet Riot had, like better produced. Yeah,
a little bit. Well, no, probably less produced. I mean, it's Slade were loud. I mean, their entire thing was stomping your feet and shouting a lot. But they wrote some really catchy songs. You know, just really good hooks. And like I say, yeah, you listen to them and it's like, yeah, this is very definitely one of the biggest influences on what eventually became the hair metal scene of the 80s. The hair metal stuff had more of the guitar virtuoso stuff and a lot of that kind of thing going on, but in terms of the underlying vibe of it, that's kind of where it started. And and there are precedents to Slade as well. I mean, it's impossible to say this is where anything started, because it's a spectrum, it grows, everything, so it's the influence of something else. But
so is that like Slayed or
Salde? Although it's funny you say that, because they had an album called Slayed, Slayed. Oh.
So they were aware.
they were aware
what the name sounded like.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, and if you look at videos of them, they are just wearing some of the silliest 1970s glam costumes you will ever see in your life. But they rock. But they slayed. But I use that as an example of, for me personally, that's an example of, once I discovered Slade, it just opened up my understanding of hair metal and rock and what came after that. So, that going backwards, discovering the origins of a lot of this stuff. The Fast Car is another example. People hearing that now for the first time, the Luke Combs version, thinking it's a great song. They go back, they listen to the original, they hopefully listen to that entire Tracy Chapman album. And here in the context of everything else she was doing, it just opens up this whole new world of music to listen to in the present. But I also think just an understanding of the growth of music and the way music interplays, and that, we, like everything else, we talk about genre or style of music, whatever. And it's just, it all overlaps. Like everything influences everything else. And it's richer, for myself.
Yeah, it feels it's richer. It's more interconnected. It feels just like cozier or something.
Rather than
familiar.
Rather than being a divisive thing, which music tribes, particularly when you're young, I'm into this and you're not, therefore you suck. Breaking down those walls of genre barriers, I think, is important. And just, love the music you love, And,
so speaking of divisive, there's an episode that we want to do. Probably not next week, because next week we're going to be a little special. I'm going to be away at PCAACA, so we're going to hopefully have our annual show where we talk to people from our favorite conference. I think I'm the only one from the show going this year. But so not next week, but probably coming up soon. I think we want to do a little bit of a different concept, a similar show to today, but I think maybe a little more divisive, because we want to talk about movie remakes and reboots and what are effectively, I'd say, covers with movies.
That's a fair way of talking about it.
Yeah,
because we don't think of remake movies as a cover version, but it kind of is.
Mm-hmm. Right, because I'll write something up for the blog, but I made a comment recently just on just a random Facebook is my social media of choice because, like, I don't like microblogging. I'm too long-winded to just do Twitter streams. I'll use them, but I like to, like, get some thoughts down. And I was recently talking about the rebooted Crow movie that's coming out, and I posted my thoughts on the reimagining of the character of Eric Draven, originally played by Brandon Lee, now being played by Bill Skarsgård, and posted thoughts, and it turns out the internet has thoughts too. So I think we're gonna we want to talk about the idea of reboots and movies. So if you have thoughts, you know, maybe leave some comments here in on the blog as to what, you know, do you think that movie reboots are just covers this in the same way as music, or is it different? That's the thing that I think we want.
If, like the internet, you have thoughts.
So, anyway, Stephanie, anything you'd like to promote?
No, not really. Just world peace. World peace.
You're going to promote world peace?
World peace, okay, good.
I don't know. I mean, might as well say something positive.
Okay, good. If you'd like to promote world peace, please do it in the name of Stephanie. Sorry, your PhD. Wayne, what about you?
You know. No.
Yay.
If you're in that class at Pitt. Like,
if you happen to be in that class in Pitt, I look forward to being there.
As always, you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, all the places, always at Chris Maverick. Also, I never say it, but I'm also, I guess I do sometimes say it, I am also on Blue Sky and Threads and Mastodon. Oh wow, I never remember to post to Mastodon. I infrequently remember to post to Blue Sky and Threads, but I'm on them, and I'm definitely on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So follow me all those places at Chris Maverick. You can follow the show on Twitter and Facebook and Blue Sky at Vox Popcast. You can follow the show's blog at www.voxpopcast.com, where we post about whatever we're going to be talking about next week when we have time to do it. Hopefully I'll write a little something about the movie reboot show that we're going to do. And next week, we'll be talking about PCA stuff. So anyway, you can leave a comment on this episode or any other episode and let us know your thoughts. You can suggest topics or things you want to hear us talk about. Sometimes we pick guests from the blog. If you enjoy the show, and we certainly hope you do, then please subscribe to us on iTunes or Spotify or Pandora or wherever the hell you get podcasts from. And do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you leave us a 5-star review, not just a rating, that really helps us out, especially if you give us 5 stars on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. That gooses the algorithm, makes us more popular, and makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. I would like to thank Maximilian of Thoughtform Music for our epic theme song, Building
Songwriter,
epically, and playing us out. I'd once again like to thank Stephanie for joining us. I'd like to thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.